3, 2, 1. In the 1920s and 30s, Otto Geist and other archaeologists were ranging the island of St. Lawrence looking for human remains. The island attracted scientists because of its people's cultural connections to both sides of the Bering Strait and the island's suspected role in the prehistoric migration of humans into North America. Many of the remains gathered from St. Lawrence eventually formed the core of UA Museum's anthropological collection. Other remains were traded with institutions around the globe, exchanges which further enhanced the museum's holdings. Gary Selinger, who is coordinating the museum's repatriation program, admits those collecting methods stain the integrity of the scientific process.
When we're talking about human remains, it's actual skeletons of children, women, men, elders, that archaeologists would go into a village and excavate a graveyard. And they had federal permits to authorize them to do so, and the native folks in the village standing there watching had no power to do anything to stop it, even though the archaeologists were digging up their grandparents and aunts and uncles.
Selinger says with time, Western scientists became more sensitive to the values of Native Americans. Even so, he says, when Congress passed the Native Americans Graves Protection and Repatriation Act in 1990, many curators and anthropologists feared museums would be raided and collections lost. But he says the process has actually worked out well for the University of Alaska by forging new alliances with Native villages and councils.
You can never correct or rectify the desecration of a grave, but hopefully this will start a healing process for the Native community, and over time, there'll be a better understanding between the museums and the Native communities, hopefully.
The words of Gerald Sonorek Sr., president of Gamble's IRA Council, echo Selinger. As a boy, Sonorek remembers seeing the archaeological digs.
It's the beginning of a healing process for the whole community, knowing that these people, these remains that were taken out long time ago are finally coming back to rest in their own land.
UA's repatriation is not only the first for the museum, but the first return for the island. And now, says Sonorek, he hopes other institutions around the world will follow suit. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Lisa Hay and Greg Krause spend 2 days a week in jail. The two work with prisoners at the Fairbanks Correctional Center, where they run a batterer's counseling program. For each class, up to 22 inmates gather in a room to listen and to talk. They listen as Hay and Krause speak about topics ranging from the cycle of violence to communication skills and stress reduction techniques. And inmates get a chance to talk about their own experiences. Though these classes are held in prison, Krause says this isn't a correctional program.
It's not like these people come in and they're violent and it's our job to fix them. I don't think anybody can do that. For some of them, hopefully we can get them interested in wanting to fix themselves, and then if they do, you know, we have a whole big list of tools in the form of lectures and paperwork and discussions that they can use to their advantage if they want them. And some people will sit through the class and not want them and ignore the fact that there's a lot of alternatives out there for them, and other people will be really interested and want to find out everything they can about how they can make their life a more comfortable situation, especially in relationships.
Krause says the two show the group through their interaction what's appropriate behavior between the sexes. Hay adds they talk about sex role stereotypes, taking responsibility for actions, and the effects of those actions on the victim and children. And she says they're real.
Sometimes we argue, sometimes we do role playing. Greg is a wonderful male role model for these guys, who many of them have never seen a male who relates to a female on an equal basis. I'm the assertive female. I'm the woman who doesn't take any crap from, you know, with them. And they see that through our interaction how two people of the opposite sex can relate to each other.
Jane Andrine, director of the Council on Domestic Violence, which administers funding for the program, says the new laws direct her group to write Department of Corrections standards for batterers' intervention programs. She says domestic violence offenders often deny they're responsible, and that has to be addressed in these programs.
One of the things that we hear a lot from victims is that something that is presented as very healthy in group can be, or in their individual sessions or whatever it is that they're receiving, can be turned around and then used against the victim. One of the things that we believe very strongly in is that a batterer's program has got to hold, has to hold the offender accountable for their actions and the violence.
Andrine says part of that accountability includes paying for their own therapy. While the council will continue funding prison programs, it will no longer finance community-based services for ex-cons. Krauss says if society is going to become a place where domestic violence is unacceptable, people who've grown up in abusive homes will have to learn new behaviors.
Biggest issue among all these guys is that they're used to a kind of life where they have not experienced real, honest, intimate kind of relationship. They don't know what other people are talking about when they talk about sincere love. And so for us to suggest that that's something that's within their grasp is pretty unrealistic for them a lot of the time, because they've substituted in their life this stuff, control, instead of honesty and intimacy. And so if they feel like they can control somebody else, that's as close as they'll ever get to being able to get that other person's love. And so now we're trying to convince them, hey, that's not true. If you give up this control stuff, you might be able to get the love stuff, which is a lot better.
Krauss says breakthroughs do come as the inmates talk about their experiences. Hay and Krauss both say their classes need to be a place where batterers can talk freely. And even when the whole group disagrees on a topic, they can be sure it won't turn violent. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher. In 1993, things looked great for the Interior Regional Housing Authority. With several new housing grants in the budget, the organization had just asked HUD for permission to do things a little differently. The IRHA became the first Alaskan housing authority to be its own general contractor. This meant management could control local hire, choose the materials for housing, and even hire the architect. The IRHA was scheduled to develop 94 units. People moved into homes in Tok and Nikolai by the end of 1995. But before projects in other villages could be completed, the budget ran out. Present Director Joe Wilson says things got out of control. Management had made expensive decisions, like using super-insulated wall panels instead of conventional ones. Wilson says there were other reasons, especially at the Tok site, where the homes were scattered out.
Usually that runs the cost up. I know a lot of communities don't like to see low-income housing built in a row, but the cost is cheaper to do it that way. With the budgets you have to work with, when you have to put one house here and then in the same community, three or four blocks down the street or on the other end of the community, build another house, and that runs the cost up considerably.
Wilson says the authority rerouted $2.7 million from repair grants to pay for the cost overruns in Tok and Nikolai. Then the board started asking questions about the creative accounting, eventually prompting the director to resign. A HUD team assessed the damage, called the authority a high-risk operation, and shut down all new construction projects. From then on, all IRHA functions, from meeting payroll to replacing wood stoves, needed HUD approval. HUD's Native America Programs Administrator Marlon Knight says his office has been reinventing the IRHA.
We decided with this intense effort that back in July that we needed to sort of back off and let them have an opportunity to perform on their own. We felt that they time to take flight and see how they were doing. So we've basically have not been involved with them as intensely.
Knight says an operational review conducted in September produced good results, and if the next two go as well, HUD will lift the high-risk status. They've already let the authority continue its abandoned construction projects. Wilson says the IRHA's plans may have been a good idea, just too much too soon. He says the IRHA acted too ambitiously, robbing Peter to pay Paul.
I think when HUD approved like almost 100 units in 10 villages, that was kind of going overboard. It would have been much better for any company that had no experience, maybe to take one project on first and then develop the skill and capability and then go on to bigger and better things from there.
Wilson says the IRHA has been working with a national consulting firm to bring the accounting department up to date. And for now, the authority is concentrating on repairing and better managing its existing units. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Bill Stearns has been working on locating a landfill on the upper Susitna Valley for over a year.
It's not in my backyard project, and we started knowing that, and we prepared ourselves with as much research and positioning in the community as we could to be informative, be open, attend as many meetings, do everything in advance to prepare the community for this.
Stearns arrived at last week's meeting at the Trapper Creek Community Council armed with studies supporting his proposal to use an old gravel pit at mile 107 of the park's highway for a landfill. The proposed landfill would enable Stearns to stop trucking garbage 68 miles to the Mapsu Borough's centralized landfill outside of Palmer. Not only would this cut his cost, but it would increase his ability to handle garbage. And the garbage business in the upper Susitna is definitely growing. Not only will the new Prince's Lodge increase the flow of trash, but the area has and continues to experience steady growth. To get community support for his landfill, Stearns is going to have to convince people like Mike Carpenter, the Trapper Creek postmaster.
My concern is it's a permanent thing. It's going to be here forever, so I want to know what the long term is. And my concern is I feel that because we're a very small residential area, that the entire borough could look toward us in the future, like, by God, it's a good idea. Let's bring all of our garbage up north and get it away from Westville and Palmer.
Carpenter's vision of Stearns' landfill becoming a final resting place for Wasilla and Palmer trash is not a likely one. The law covering this type of small rural facility says garbage can only come from within a 50-mile radius of the landfill. At the KTNA News Cabin, I'm Johanna Urich.
A garage isn't the usual setting for animal surgeries. But Fairbanks veterinarian and Yukon Quest dog musher, Dr. Mark May, recently brought his clinic to Galena, and it works.
We provide almost full veterinary services in Galena, certainly for some very extensive, sophisticated surgeries, we'll refer them to town, but we can provide all of the examination and vaccination services and routine elective surgeries such as spays, neuters, some tumor removals. We performed our first dental procedures this clinic in Galena, so it's an expanding menu of services.
Now in its fifth year, Galena is May's most regular bush clinic, though he's worked in Fort Yukon and Kotzebue. Most village residents are reluctant to send an animal to town because air freight and boarding fees make such care expensive. Some animal owners, like Evelyn Burgett, give required shots on their own, but advanced care and diagnosis calls for more expertise.
Well, I know it's valuable to me because Sheldon's like a part of our family, and it's always good to know that he's in good health and he's up on his vaccinations, but I really appreciate the service with the vet coming out here, and to me it's a valuable service.
The local dog and cat population has grown because some pet owners can't afford vet services, but May does offer a payment plan to help. Mark May says he visits Galena mostly for a change of scenery. As a musher who has traveled by dog team throughout the bush, he knows there's a high demand for vet services. May says the Galena clinic barely breaks even, and that's after Frontier Airlines donated a plane ticket. Even so, May hopes to expand his bush clinic.
I have plans in the near future of running the clinics out of a riverboat. And when we can operate out of a riverboat instead of our bags that are flown in, we'll be able to bring more equipment and provide more services. I have traveled the river quite a bit, and I have quite a few clients in villages like Tanana, Ruby, Manly. So I could conceivably leave my house in Fairbanks, which is on the Chena River, and do clinics all the way down to Galena.
Without easy access to regular vet services, Galena pet owners rely on May's annual visits, their own skills, and the Tanana Chief's vaccination program to keep their animals healthy. Perhaps next year, Galena's upriver neighbors will also see the traveling vet come to their villages. In Galena, I'm Mike Spindler.
State fisheries biologist 2-1. State fisheries biologist at Cordova, Slim Morstad, says that for the first time since 1992, herring numbers in Prince William Sound are substantially above the 22,000-ton minimum spawning threshold.
The population's back. We seem to have made it through the disease cycle. The population's healthy, and that's why we're conducting a fishery this spring.
Morstad says the total herring biomass estimate for Prince William Sound is 37,000 tons, about 15% of which will be available for harvest through some 267 permits for the various herring fisheries. The first begins next month with the food and bait opening. Sherry Shaw directs Cordova Fishermen United, the organization which represents many of the Prince William Sound fishers affected.
It's going to jumpstart our spring season again. It's going to put some more money back into the economy, and it's going to brighten our day. It's been kind of sad around here the last few years with no herring fishery, and we're now back to a longer fishing season than just May 15th until the end of September.
Despite the prospect, Shaw and many area fishermen remain resentful about why the herring fishery crashed to begin with back in 92. Shaw acknowledges there's been no study to date which has proven what so many believe.
The herring, they're anywhere from like 4 to 8 year fish, meaning they return in that amount of time from when they go out and grow and come back. Well, it just so happens that when the herring spawn, you know, it was the first part of April, so when they were spawning and the little herring fry were coming out, they were coming out into the oil. And so after the fourth year until just now, we have not been able to fish, so you make the call.
Shaw's perspective is not shared entirely by Fish and Game. Morstad believes the situation is more complicated and that the fisheries themselves may be just as responsible as the spill for stressing the population. Morstad says the department has two independent biologists studying to find out what stressed herring enough to make them susceptible to the immune disease and associated fungus which killed so many. Meanwhile, with stocks healthy again, fishermen are thinking about the upcoming season. Shaw estimates the price for the expected 5,500-ton total herring harvest will be upwards of $1,000 per ton. Next spring's Persane sacro fishery will account for most of the catch, with just under 3,000 tons allotted. November's food and bait opening is allocated the next highest tonnage at 785, with the spring's gillnet sacro and spawn-on kelp fisheries making up the balance of the harvest. In Valdez, I'm Dan Broth.
Elders in Tanana see a steady decline in waterfowl populations, and they blame airboats. Gerald Nicolai with the Tanana Tribal Council says more and more airboats have been appearing in traditional hunting areas. And he says this fall, for the first time, the boats showed up at Fish Lake, a prime waterfowl nesting area.
The last two hunting seasons, we've seen more destruction to waterfowl habitat than ever before, because they just completely run over everything. They can't see through where the nest is in the grass or anything. They go where they only need a little water to go any place. In some places, they could ride right over the grass, so they could just practically go anywhere.
So earlier this month, Tanana's Tribal Council petitioned the Federal Subsistence Board to ban airboats from federal lands around their village on the Yukon and Tanana Rivers. The Regional Advisory Council supports the move, and it follows the State Game Board's decision in April to ban airboats for moose hunting in the Nenana Control Use Area. Local airboat operators are battling the state in court over that decision, and they refuse to comment on the latest move to restrict their access. But Dick Bishop, director of the Alaska Outdoor Council, says the Tanana Council's action is less about airboats than local control.
I think it's another example of an attempt by a local community to establish the precedent of local control over fish and wildlife resources, even though they may be on state and private lands and navigable waters. And I think that this Tanana proposal is really kind of a copycat. They smelled a little blood, sort of like a school of piranhas, when the board passed the Nenana controlled use areas and thought, hey, that's one way to put some constraints on non-local people.
Bishop and the Outdoor Council support the airboaters' suit against the state, saying there's no biological basis for restricting airboats. And he suspects the same holds for Tanana. It's uncertain how far Tanana's petition will go. The matter is being studied before heading to the Federal Subsistence Board. Either way, Bishop and others believe airboaters will be targeted for more restrictions in the future. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Earlier this year, Congress overhauled the nation's telecommunication laws, essentially removing barriers between cable, telephone, and internet industries. GCI's Dana Tindall says that signaled to telephone companies that to stay competitive, they'd have to provide new services.
Where you providing all the telecommunication needs for a consumer, from your local phone service to long distance to cable, and you can combine it all through a single cable into the subscriber's home, getting a lot more efficiency, a lot faster data speeds, and a lot better service to the consumer.
Service that includes internet access as well as telephone and cable delivery. So Tindall says, with the purchase of three Alaskan cable companies serving communities from Ketchikan to Nome, including Anchorage and Fairbanks, GCI is positioned to dominate more than the cable market.
We've actually been asked in different communities to come in and provide local phone service. So we may take some of those opportunities first and come to Fairbanks later or come to Fairbanks earlier. But it is GCI's goal to provide all of a consumer's communication services throughout the state in the next 5 years.
The news doesn't surprise PTI, the company buying Fairbanks' phone utility. The pending cable purchase by PTI's rival was a selling point when persuading Fairbanks voters to part with their local phone company. To stay competitive, though, PTI will also have to provide a high-tech menu of telecommunications options, says Farah O'Sullivan. O'Sullivan is an industry consultant based out of California's Silicon Valley. And she acknowledges future customers of any phone service will be paying for the new digital bells and whistles of the 21st century.
They probably will not be paying as much as those consumers who want all of the services, but definitely for the base infrastructure, which would be the wires and the cabling and all the extra little doodads they have to put in to facilitate the high-end customer who wants everything. That customer that just wants a phone line will be footing part of the bill.
Not necessarily, says Fritz Messer, broadcast professor at State University of New York and fellow at the Annenberg Washington Program in Communication Policy. He says two carriers competing for customers may well keep prices down. Further, he says, state public utilities commissions will mandate certain reduced basic services, so-called lifeline services. But Messer warns the brave new world of options promised by pundits could contain a few lemons.
It creates, on one hand, the opportunities for consumers to spend large amounts of money on technologies that rapidly become obsolete. And those people who bought beta VCRs know exactly what I'm talking about. It also provides the opportunity to sort of meld these together so that we don't have to have a separate computer and a television and a VCR. If we could perhaps merge all of that together into one home entertainment unit in the future. And that's a possibility, too.
Indeed, says Messer, the move is called convergence, and it seems likely consumers in Fairbanks and across Alaska will soon be offered some all-in-one device within the next decade. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
In spite of all the pressure animal cruelty activists have put on dog mushers, the sport continues to grow. 9 years ago, mushers organized a symposium to address issues and learn new techniques. Barb Gilson, vice president of the Alaska Dog Mushers Association, says a decade ago, most dog research was done on greyhounds. Since then, researchers have turned some attention toward northern breeds.
Nutrition has changed tremendously in just the 9-10 years that the symposium has been going on. And the same is with equipment and training techniques. We're always advancing and trying new things and finding ones that work and things that don't work. And that's why you always got more information you can learn.
In addition to basic classes like Mushing 101, drivers will discuss the future of the sport and the responsibility of each individual. A session with vets is set for Sunday, where a panel will talk about the latest research. People often look at mushing as an adult sport, but in the last few years, the ADMA has actively recruited young people. Kathy Brooks says 40 people applied for scholarships to come in from the bush, and there's still room for more.
The kids are the future, and the future of dog mushing, and so we'd like to spend some time educating them so that hopefully they can avoid some of the pitfalls and the mistakes that some of us made getting into the sport. And the other thing is to just educate them what the sport is about and excite them, give them something to do.
Caring for a dog team can be a full-time job, and for young people, it can be a rewarding discipline as well. The symposium begins Friday at Alaskaland and runs through the weekend. On Friday evening, catch a free distance mushing workshop. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. As if living under the shadow of the $100 million Delta Barley Project weren't bad enough, the town's economic linchpin, Fort Greeley, is set for closure. Delta, some say, gets no respect. But Harley Olberg, challenger for House District 35, has a plan to restore Delta's economy and at the same time make government more accountable. While it's not his idea, he's all over it like locusts on barley.
I've got to give a byline to a fellow by the name of Holly Zocco, who was the first to mention to me about a year and a half ago that after the Fort Greeley closure was announced, he said, geez, that'd be a great place to move the capital. And it has just evolved in my beady little mind since then to the point where I now think it's a viable idea.
The way Olberg tells it, Fort Greeley's a perfect location, and not just because it's on the road system.
Fort Greeley is a small, complete, self-contained city with hundreds of housing units, a store, a commissary, a PX, a motor pool, a theater, a chapel, a bowling alley, a swimming pool, tennis courts, ski hill, year-round world-class airport, the latest telecommunications network that federal dollars can buy. It is sitting there waiting for something like this to happen.
Olberg's plan calls for moving the legislature, which by definition is the capital, by 2003. He envisions daily jet service from Anchorage and perhaps Juneau. And among the constituents along the Richardson Highway, he says the idea is well received.
Everybody's first reaction is, But then after everybody thinks about it for a little bit and has a chance and you discuss it a little bit, I'm getting a very, very positive reaction.
But when it comes to a capital move, critics are everywhere.
Capital move, we don't need it.
Former Senator Arlis Sterjalowski served on the first capital move site selection committee.
I think it's a very parochial issue in that it's not a widespread kind of a movement, but again, it's the political season and all kinds of things kind of poke up and through the snow, and I think this is yet another one.
Sterjalowski's not alone. Olberg's general election opponent, Gene Kabina, calls the plan an election year gimmick.
Politically, it's just not going to happen, and so I don't want to give people the impression that here's a solution that we've got for you, but really, after knowing what the whole makeup of the legislature is like, it's not going to happen, so we need to focus on things that can happen.
Kabina says the Delta Greeley Community Coalition took up the idea shortly after the Pentagon announced the base closure. Coalition Director Ray Woodruff says because nothing's changed since the last capital move vote, coalition leaders decided to bet the town's future elsewhere.
We didn't think that the, the feeling politically would be sufficient to cause us to be able to make it happen. And what we need is stuff that will happen and not waste our time on stuff that won't, you know, it doesn't have much of a chance of happening.
Woodruff says given the difficulty involved in moving the capital, the coalition's placing its efforts on agriculture and tourism. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
They're making snow at Birch Hill. They're testing the lifts and grooming the trails, but before the ski area opens next week, Supervisor John Binder says he wants help designing a park for the growing number of snowboarders who visit the slope.
I'm an older person and I ski, but I don't snowboard. And the kids are asking me questions I can't answer. Things like slide rails and half pipes and quarter pipes and gap jumps and things like that. So I was just inviting all the boarders that are interested to come into the lodge here at Birch Hill at 2 p.m. on Saturday the 19th and educate me. And we will try to design a snowboard park and maybe try to build what they would like to have.
Binder says almost half the kids on the slope are snowboarders, and since he's got the snow shaping technology, he'd like to build them what they want. And what they want takes a whole new vocabulary to understand. Larry Davis, owner of a Fairbanks snowboard shop, says a snowboard park works best when there are plenty of half-pipe jumps.
You have this this large build-up area, and then it dishes down into a semicircle shape. And from there, you go, you know, you basically drop in, and basically you come up, jump the ridges and stuff like that, do your aerial maneuvers, and then come back down, and then just move up to the other side and then do, you know, aerial maneuvers or tricks or handstands or whatever it is, you know, that you want to do, and then come back down and just go down the pipe doing that.
Local snowboarders do have access to tabletops and quarter pipes at local ski areas, which are fine for small jumps, but they're made with snow while professional style ones are built up from a gravel or earth base. Davis says the nearest snowboard park's in Anchorage, so the first lodge to set one up here could find loyal snowboarders lining up on opening day. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Part of the interest is because people were originally asking about the Nelchina caribou herd, and they're thinking Unit 13 and the Tier 1 hunt that's available to them. And, you know, when they ask where the animals are, you know, that leads to the question, or leads to the answer that they're in Unit 12 and now what. So I think there's going to be more interest in this hunt than there has been in the past.
The Copper Valley Electric Association Board announced the resignation of manager Clayton Hurlis effective immediately at a board meeting in Glen Allen Wednesday evening. Hurlis gives no specific reason for his speedy departure, but does say the board offered him a reasonable deal and that he leaves on positive terms. Looking back on his years with Copper Valley, Hurlis says the Intertie project was his primary focus.
We obviously were unable to bring that to successful fruition, and so it's been frustrating for everyone. But it's a great little company. It's a great bunch of people, and that's all I want to say. I don't have any comments to make. That's up to somebody else now.
The 65-year-old Hurlis says he considers himself officially retired now. Board member Don Taylor of Glen Allen says Hurlis's moving on opens the door for change at Copper Valley.
This is an opportunity for us to get new blood in, new thinking into the process of upgrading our operations, and maybe we can get some positive reactions to some of our proposals that have been put before the board that have been shelved or avoided.
Taylor and the rest of the CVEA board will be working with administration and finance manager Robert Wilkinson for the time being. Wilkinson was appointed on an interim basis by the board Wednesday night to take over for the departed Hurlis. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
Galena might have one name, but it's really two towns. Old Town's located close to the Yukon, right in the flood zone. New Town, on higher ground, is about a mile and a half away. Since 1989, Galena officials have worked to get a new road to connect the two sites above the Yukon floodplain. The existing road parallels the Yukon River and is well within the flood's reaches. Work finally began a few weeks ago. Construction crews are moving 113,000 yards of fill from gravel bars in the river up to the road site. Manager Howard Hanzi says several hurdles make this a challenging project.
Obviously the weather and the working out of the river here and the impending ice conditions and things like that is a large factor. It's difficult to work in these kind of temperatures. It's hard on the equipment, and it's hard for the guys that have to be out there for 10 to 12 hours a day in these kind of temperatures.
Crews are working 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. Temperatures have already reached 10 below and will fall farther as winter deepens. Crews will stay on the job until the gravel freezes so hard it won't come out of the trucks. They'll finish the job in the spring and then move the equipment to Keokuk for another road project. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is footing the cost of $1.9 million. The money is being funneled through the Loudoun Village Council and subcontracted to Ghana U, the Galena Village Corporation. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
Robert Bonfilio says his harmonica can bridge the gap between popular and classical music. Music and art, he says, are at their best when the artist takes ordinary things and skews them slightly.
If you look at, let's say, Van Gogh paintings, you see a picture of a guy sowing seeds in a field, or somebody shucking corn, or somebody, you know, some women washing clothing in a stream. This is everyday life. And he just changes the colors and the way he looks. So why don't you look at it from this side? And when you see it that way, we understand all the nuances. And therefore, we can be emotional about that. I mean, I have to remember all of the great speeches in Shakespeare, the words an average five-year-old kid knows. So what happened with classical music is we got so involved in complexities that it was like the king without his clothes. I mean, the complexities became the real music, and it therefore didn't relate to anybody.
Bonfilio says by stripping the complexities of classical music and adding the familiar tones of his harmonica, he can reach the masses.
We can relate to little nuances like a bent note in blues. You know, if you hear... I get a feeling out of that as an American, because we know that. So all I have to do is turn that on the pedestal and put it into something that says, well, take a look at it from this way. You know, listen to it with a little bit more development. And that needs to happen.
And that leads to an evolution in music which Bonfilio wants to develop, an amalgamation of classical and rock and roll. He points to Duke Ellington and George Gershwin's mixture of jazz and classical music as an example of this type of experimentation. Bonfilio lives in New York, but spends most of his time traveling and playing with symphonies around the world. He's in Fairbanks this week, in Oregon the next, and will be in China soon. And just as he's twisting music into new forms, he's taken the same approach with marketing. He's appeared on television shopping channels to sell his CDs.
I've been selling a lot of recordings on QVC, and everybody looks at you and says, what? What are you talking about, QVC? Well, we were just on with the Time Life Project. We sold 15,000 CDs in 12 minutes. Then the musicians come in, well, how do I get on that? It went on the Billboard charts, you know. You're just popping that many. I guess there's somebody that sits there with their credit cards and watches it.
Bonfilio owns a third of the High Harmony Records label. He's now working with a new band called Harmonica Americana. So the latest evolution in music will be coming soon to a cable shopping network near you. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
During the last 2 weeks, KUAC has asked listeners to visit our front porch, where you call in questions for the candidates and we play their responses on the air. In this first installment, we'll hear from three listeners who posed questions to candidates for Borough Assembly, School Board, and State House.
Brian Fox, District 33. Question: is there any candidate at all who is soul enough to stand up against the maniacal inquisition of the war on drugs and end the impositions into people's private lives? I would like an answer to that, please. Thank you very much.
Okay, this is Bob Boko, and I'm running for State House District 30, and I'm responding to a question from a person from District 33 in regard to the war on drugs and what he says is maniacal inquisition. I think it's basically a privacy thing with him, but I feel that drugs are a huge detriment in our society to young people, and I think whatever you do in your home is also a falls out into the streets, and I think that use of drugs, no matter where it is, should be prohibitive.
I'm Representative Tom Bryce with District 30. What we need to look at is decreasing the demand on drugs. Programs such as the DARE program in our schools goes a long way at taking away demand to have the drugs in society. That we need to look at providing enough jobs so people, you know, have something to do with their lives. Drug use is often associated with, you know, lifestyles that are not very productive quite often.
This is Gary Wilkin. I'm running for a Senate seat O. I certainly respect the constitutional right of privacy, and I'll defend it vigorously, but however, I'll make whatever efforts necessary to rid our society of illegal drugs, particularly when youth are involved. Our state should take the steps necessary to, one, educate our citizenship, particularly our youth, regarding the dangers of illicit drugs, and those dangers are not only legal but personal health. And secondly, our state should bring the full force of the law to punish those that choose to deal with illegal drugs.
Hi, my name is Ronnie Rosenberg. I'm in House District 33, Senate District Q, and I want to know what everybody's going to do to help protect our animals, help protect against animal cruelty. That's my question for the borough candidates, whether they favor the proposed ordinance so that animal control can enforce cruelty ordinances for animals other than dogs, and for the state and federal candidates, whether they will favor things to protect our animals who can't protect themselves. Thanks.
My name's Kevin McGehee, and I'm running for seat D on the Borough Assembly. Everyone who matters is against cruelty to animals. Unfortunately, this proposed ordinance, even with the follow-up so-called exemption for farming and animal husbandry, places the borough in a position to regulate farming practices. Regulating agriculture is not a legitimate function of municipal government. I favor an ordinance to fight against animal cruelty, but I want one that's done right. That means I can't support the one that's on the ballot.
This is Guy Satley, candidate for Assembly Seat D. I'm responding to your question. I strongly support the borough ballot Proposition B, which would allow the borough animal control to prohibit cruelty to domestic animals borough-wide. Horses and other domestic animals need this protection, which can be done at minimal cost to the taxpayer.
My name is Dan Lasota. I'm running for Borough Assembly Seat K. Thanks for the question, Ms. Rosenberg. If the proposition passes, the borough will do what it had been doing for several years, preventing cruelty to animals. It's important to remember that cruelty is defined as torturing, starving, poisoning, or encouraging animals to fight. With cruelty prevention powers, the borough can stop abusers from doing these things to all animals, as we do today with dogs. There won't be any additional cost because the actual caseload is very small and we already have the trained staff on hand. I hope people join me in voting yes for this on October 8th.
Cameron Carter, Borough Assembly, Seat K.
Animal cruelty is tragic and should be addressed, but the proposed ballot proposition is poorly thought out and doesn't answer any questions. It does not address the extent of authority the borough wants. It does not place any limits on this power. It does not reveal the added cost to the taxpayer. We need to have existing laws enforced before we give more power to the borough.
This is Nancy Webb. I'm running for Borough Assembly Seat E. Well, it goes to show, what would we do without lawyers? It took a mistreated pig in a lawsuit to bring to light the fact the borough technically has dog control powers, not animal control powers right now. I'm voting yes on the proposition in the upcoming ballot that would correct the code to say animal control, which I think was the intention all along. You don't have to be an animal rights zealot to vote for it, and I don't think it's a plot to expand borough powers, just a sensible housekeeping measure to bring the code in line with what the public expects.
This is Bob Boko calling, and I am running for State House in District 30. I'm responding to a question in District 33. There are presently laws against animal cruelty, and I think that one of the things that has to be done is some study done on this so that questions will be answered. I think we are adequately covered, and I think anything else would be a little bit more intrusive into what we want.
Hello. My name is Marilyn Biaggi. This is my question for the school board candidates. One of my major concerns is that the Fairbanks North Star Borough District lacks an attendance area policy. In order to maintain continuity and stability for families in the district, the school board needs to create and adopt a policy which provides guidelines regarding which students will attend which schools. This decision should not be left up to the sole discretion of the administration. Do you agree or disagree? If elected, will you work on the development of an attendance area policy? If so, please identify and prioritize 3 to 5 criteria you feel should be considered in the establishment of an equitable attendance area policy for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. Thank you.
My name is Jane Parrish, and I'm running for school board seat F. I feel the school board can be most effective in this area by considering long-range planning and land banking for school placement and expansion. I don't feel the school board should draw the lines. A review of transportation zones policy is scheduled to be taken up by the policy review committee. You can be a part of that process. I feel many criteria should be considered, including cost and efficiency of transportation. It's unfortunate, but cost of transportation can sometimes be a deciding factor. We have to do the best with what we have.
Jeff Deutsch, School Board, Seat F. One, if a student has attended a school for a period of time, this should be considered as a factor. Two, lives within a reasonable distance. Three, parents should be consulted prior to any attendance areas being revamped for their inputs in regards to the change. Four, what's in the best interest of the child and or family. And five, what is the student population at that particular school?
My name is Jenna Campbell, and I'm running for school board seat F, and I believe school district should be set up with common sense, never requiring students living close to school to have to attend another farther away. There should also be choice in where a student attends school. If the principal of the school is in agreement after meeting with parents and children involved, the administration should permit flexibility and negotiation in this area.
My name is Sally Shostal. I'm running for school board seat E. And first, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to give us candidates a chance to respond to some of the public questions. And my answer to this week's question was that the way I understand it, the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District already has a policy designating which children go to which schools. But I am aware of the lady's problem here, and if I get elected, I would definitely look into it further.
I am Malcolm Wright, and I'm running for school board seat G, and I do agree that there needs to be created adopted policy which provide guidelines of students on the attendance. And some of the areas that I think they need to look at is the size for pupils, for class. We need to also get parent involvement in that decision process.
This is
Jennifer Schmidt, candidate for school board seat G. As long as schools are not above capacity, parents should be able to choose the school their children attend. I believe it's appropriate for the school board to establish a policy which outlines the criteria that a school boundary committee would use in establishing school boundaries, but not for the school board to draw the lines itself. My criteria in order of priority would be safety, class size, equal access to resources outside the classroom, and the length of the bus ride.
KUAC's Front Porch aims to put you in touch with the candidates. If you have a question for the candidates, please call us. We'll help you get an answer. But we can't do it alone. We need your questions. So give us a call at 474-7491. Voters have a week to decide whether to sell the city's utility system. A consortium of private buyers have crafted a $160 million deal for the telephone, electric, district, heat, water, and sewer systems. Voters are being lobbied hard by opponents and advocates. As we hear on this week's Front Porch, candidates for city council are divided on the question as well.
My name is Robert Goodwin. I live in 908 Smythe, Fairbanks number 3, my voting precinct. My question is, how can someone prove or disprove that four companies out to make a profit can operate for the same as the municipal utility sections being operated as a nonprofit? It seems to me that four companies out for profit, your rates are going to be raised. Can somebody disprove that? Thank you.
Hello, this is Shirley Dementiff. I'm running for Fairbanks City Council, seat E. I believe that the four companies that are attempting to buy municipal utilities will eventually be charging as high rates as it is proposed that MUS will have to. Eventually, after the three-year period, rates will be the same either way we go. Please vote no on this MUS sale package proposal.
I'm John Immel, and I'm running for City Council, seat E. It is a well-proven fact that private companies are more efficient than government operations. Otherwise, government would own and run everything. The city-owned utilities, which should be a business, are run like a government with a change in management with most every election. Private business, free of politics and regulated by the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, will provide lower rates than the city could provide. Thank you.
I'm Jerry Cleworth, running for City Council, CDF. MUS as a whole has to make a profit in order to fund capital projects and pay the city $3.6 million per year for payment in lieu of taxes. Whether we keep government control or we privatize, profits have to be made. Unfortunately, with deregulation, the city's ability to keep making a profit will be greatly reduced as our telecommunications monopoly is broken up. Private companies have already negotiated tentative contracts with city bargaining units with a net savings over city contracts. They simply are more efficient and have the capital to provide better services in a rapidly changing industry.
Frank Turney, I'm running for City Council, CDF. A public utility can provide more services for less because they are tax exempt, and their motivation is responsibility to their customers. A private utility is responsible to its stockholder and profits. Those profits come from you, the ratepayers. I encourage you to vote no on October 8th, the MUS sale. Thank you.
If you have a question for the candidates, call KUAC at 474-7491. We'll record it, put it to the politicians, and try to get you some answers. I'm John McWhorter. Alaskans recognize that paid lobbyists wield a lot of power when legislators draft our state laws. People have suggested many ways to reduce that influence, including moving the Capitol. While others believe reworking campaign finance is a more realistic goal, one caller to Front Porch offered another possibility, rewriting a rule governing legislative procedure.
Hi, my name is Rich Seifert, District 33. Right now, the rules in the House and Senate for getting bills out of committee require that the bills be passed out by a vote of show of hands. In order to eliminate the influence of lobbyists in how a bill is passed out of committee, one thing that could do would be change the rules and have the bills be passed out by a simple secret ballot. How do you feel about this, and would you vote for that change of rules if you got elected?
This is Gary Wilkin, candidate for Senate O. That's an interesting question, and one I've given quite a bit of thought about. But our governing process selects fellow citizens to represent their neighbors in setting law and policy for our state. Allowing secret ballots on public business is a dangerous precedent, and one that I really think is only going to increase the influence of lobbyists. We're elected to lead by making informed and educated decisions, and then we're held accountable for those decisions. So therefore, they must be done in public.
I'm David Guttenberg, and I'm running for Senate seat O. And I don't believe that any vote in a legislature should be secret. There's too much of the smoke and mirrors game in a legislative process. And legislators need to be responsible for their actions, and calling for a secret ballot is not a positive change.
This is Ron Gould, candidate for Senate seat Q, state of Alaska. My suggestion would be that they should not only show their hands, but raise them and be counted by name and number. And that in that way, how people vote in these offices would be known. And then if they're influenced by a lobbyist, they could be removed if that's the choice that the voters should make. Secrecy doesn't seem to me to be an answer to any public government meeting, rules, or whatever.
This is Representative John Davies from District 29. It's a pleasure to visit with you on KUAC's front porch. As I understand it, to move a bill out of committee requires a unanimous vote or a roll call vote with a majority voting yes. Whatever gains there would be from a secret vote would be overshadowed by a loss in accountability. I believe it would be better to follow the money with campaign finance reform and an active and informed electorate.
This is Bonnie Williams. I'm running for House District 29, and in answer to the question from Rick Seifert, I would adamantly oppose any idea for a secret vote. Politics, in order to work in a democracy, has to be in the open, and that means the votes, absolutely the votes, have to be in the open, where everyone can see them.
This is Tom Bryce, running for House District 30. The idea of having a secret ballot to move a bill out of committee in certain instances might be something that we want to look at. Numerous pieces of legislation die each year without being able to move from the committee due to one or two lobbyist influence over that area. If it's possible to get that legislation moving through another process, I don't think that there's any problem in looking at that procedure and seeing what we can do about ensuring that good legislation moves ahead.
This is Bob Bocos, candidate for State House, District 30. A secret ballot will not solve the problem of integrity. It takes no integrity for a secret ballot. A show of hands requires that the legislator be responsible for his vote. I don't see any rule change here.
My name is Eric Holland, and I'm running for the State House representing District 31. And in response to the question about changing the rules about how to vote in committee, I would vote to keep the rules the same, because I feel like the governmental process should be as open as possible. And I think one way to do that is to have a show of hands.
I'm Claudia Douglas, a candidate for State House in District 32. I would not support a secret ballot for either legislative committee meetings or floor votes. The current practice gives voters an opportunity to know how our individual legislators are voting and if they're fulfilling the promises that they made as candidates. We hold legislators accountable by how they vote. If lobbyists are having an undue influence on legislators, it's our responsibility to vote them out of office. In contrast to my opponent, I believe in a political process that is open to the public. Thanks for the question.
This is Jeanette James. I am a representative from District 34. Actually, passing a bill from committee is a roll call vote rather than a show of hands. When a bill passes out, a committee report is signed with each committee member indicating do pass, do not pass, no recommendation, or amend. These recommendations are available for review. I would never suggest that any votes be secret. The vote of each legislator is a voice of the people. The public has a right to know what positions you take.
One footnote to today's program, several candidates were missing from this discussion. KUAC wants listeners to know we make a concerted effort to contact all candidates and give everyone an equal chance to make their views known. If you have a question for the candidates, please call KUAC's front porch at 474-7491. I'm John McWhorter.